sort of each morning, for at least for the first half of the trip, we had the opportunity to listen to Brother Cloud as he gave some thoughts on the passage here in Colossians in chapter 3, and looking at verse 16, which says, "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord." So Pastor asked us just to give, essentially to give the highlights of the trip. And some would say that the main highlight of the trip was eating at the restaurants in the the hotels. They put on a good spread. But there was a number of things that I guess stood out to me along the trip. But one thing in particular that I really enjoyed was the opportunity to hear Brother David Cloud as he shared his wisdom with us. So before we look at the highlights, I guess, of the sights, I just wanted to mention this passage. And Brother Cloud was trying to share with us his perspective of what a New Testament church should be, what it should look like, how it should operate in a sense. And he said that a true New Testament church is one in which the members exemplify the characteristics in the verse here. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom. How's that going to happen? Well, then you must be in the word, studying the word, feeding upon it. It should be dwelling in you richly in all wisdom. Teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. These are the characteristics which every member should exemplify. He said, be careful. I'm paraphrasing this because I can't remember his exact wording, but be careful not to just do church according to tradition. And this is one of the points, he had a lot to say, but there were only a couple of points that really stood out to me. And this was one of them, because it's very easy for us to come to church and just, in a sense, just be doing church. You know, this is the way we've always done it. This has become the tradition. So this is just the way we keep doing it, but not really assessing why we do it that way, not really thinking about the purpose, for example, in the song service. There's to be that aspect of teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. So for me, that really stood out, because I thought, I've gone to church for my whole life, and this is the way that I've always known church to be. And here's this man of God who's, you know, he's reaching the end of his life in a sense, and he's telling me that he's always assessing how they run their services. He's always thinking about, well, what is a tradition and what is actually in the scriptures. And I thought it was interesting, not in a proud way, but in a very bold way, he said, if it's a tradition, I can change it. And sometimes we can be very opposed to change. There's an old joke about that, you know. How many Baptists does it take to change a light bulb? Change! You know, but we can be like that. It's something that's a tradition, but you can't change it. It's the way we've always done it. And so for me, there was the spiritual lesson to be learned in all of that was that we have to be constantly assessing what we do, even things that we have done a particular way for a long time, and we just assume that that's the way it should be done. But we should be, as individuals, we should be in the Word and assessing these things and considering why we do these things the way we do them. Not that they need to change, but that we should, for ourselves, be learning why we do things the way we do them. And then it will be the conviction of the whole church that we do it this way, not just, well, that's the way it's always been done. So that was a good challenge for myself. And I trust that sharing that with you gives you an idea of some of the things that we were meditating on while we were on the trip. It wasn't just a holiday. All right, now let's get into the slides. And Pastor Dan already did an excellent overview of the trip. So there'll be a little bit of double up here, but I trust that you'll be able to get something extra out of this. So, first up, most exciting part of the trip. There have to be landing, wouldn't it? After was it an hour to Melbourne, 14 and a half hours to Dubai, and then 3.5 hours to Ben Gurion Airport, we're coming into land, and I was just thinking, at last, finally, we made it. Touchdown. Perfect. First place we went to was Ashkelon. And I, as I said, I'm just going to give you some of the highlights of the trip for myself. And the reason I think why Ashkelon was a bit of a highlight for the trip was probably because day one, first day on tour, and it was just hit the ground running. We're straight into it. We're walking around seeing these, as Pastor Dan said, a lot of rocks. But it was really interesting. The guide kept telling us, okay, a tell is more than just a mound. It's more than just a hill, you know. And for me, in my mind, I'd always thought, you know, of a tell as essentially just being a hill that used to have a city on there. And he kept saying to us, no, these cities were located in strategic places where they commanded a trade route, a source of water, and fertile lands for agricultural purposes. So there were some important factors that came into where you built a city. You didn't just build it in some random place. You obviously needed a supply of water, and it was important that it be on a trade route for economic purposes, and of course that you have good agricultural lands around about. So we went to Ashkelon Tel, one of the five great cities of the Philistines, as Pastor mentioned this morning. Ashkelon overlooks the Mediterranean Sea, and this area provided us with our first taste of the ancient civilizations in existence during the days of the judges in Israel. So as we walked up, essentially you go up to the top of the hill, and there was a nice lookout where the brother with his drone took a group photo of us. But on the top of the hill, you could clearly see all the way out across the Mediterranean. You could see the new gas rig that they've put out there, where they're going to start extracting the natural gas there soon. But it was a beautiful view. And what really struck me about this particular site was the gate. And of course, when you think of a gate today, it's a pretty simple structure that just swings on a couple of hinges. But the gate here, really gave me a much better idea of what a city gate looked like back then. The gate is 2 metres wide, 4 metres high, and 15 metres deep. And I made the same mistake as Pastor Simeon of not doing the landscape view in my photos and videos, but this was walking up the ramp through what was the gate there. And the timber there that's a part of a reconstruction to give you a bit of an idea of how big the gate was. But it's quite impressive, like it's quite deep. So you don't just, you know, it's not one step and you're past the gate. It's, I think it was a 15 metre deep gate. So you've got quite a walk to get through the gate. And that's why a lot of the gates, as Pastor Simeon mentioned, were four or even six chamber gates that had room for whether it be storage or a place for the leaders of the city to meet and discuss things relevant to the society within the city. But that really gave me a good perspective on what a gate would have looked like. I think pretty well every other gate that we saw was essentially just down to the ground. You could just see sort of like some posts and that sort of thing. But they'd actually done a really good job of trying to reconstruct that gate there. So that really stood out to me. Next we went to Gath. As I said, there'll be a little bit of overlap here. Gath is called the royal city of the Philistines. And this is the view from the road, just off to the right, is a massive power plant there. And we stopped here so that everybody could get out and take a photo from a distance. And of course, this is where Goliath and his family came from. It was one of only three cities still known to have had giants living there in Joshua's day. As we approached Gath, the guide pointed it out, and I don't know about everybody else, but I was expecting to see something spectacular, some massive ruins, and I was expecting to take some really good photos, and he pointed it out, and I thought, but it's just a hill. That's all it is. You look at it and you just go, but it's a hill. I was expecting something more. But there are ruins like this all throughout Israel that are just unexplored. There aren't enough archaeologists or enough funding, really, to explore all that there is to explore in Israel. There's so much that is yet to be discovered. So you can see not every site that we went to was impressive, or particularly impressive, I should say. This one, of course, if you drove past this and you didn't know that was Gath, you wouldn't pick it up. You wouldn't realise that on your own. If the guide had have said nothing, we could have driven past it and I never would have known. So it really just looked like a hill to us. But the archaeologists have managed to uncover the city walls and the gate, as Pastor Simeon mentioned. And while we couldn't really see much of that, the archaeologists did describe the wall as being quite a monster and the gate as one of the largest that they found. So it was quite a big city. Next we went... there you go, it's running a little video. I forgot about that. I thought I only took photos there. Yeah, so the main thing I noticed was how much had not been excavated there yet. Next, we went to the Elah Valley where David killed Goliath. And what I found interesting about being in the valley was you get a perspective on how big the valley is and also on the positioning of the Philistines, as Pastor Simeon mentioned. The Philistines were... encamped all around. As you're looking from the road, you look down the valley and you have the Israelite camp on the hill up on the left, and the Philistines were encamped all the way around the right and back around past behind where the road runs. And it really makes you think about how big the Philistine army must have been, that the Israelites were camped on one hill, but the Philistines were camped all the way around in sort of like a almost a J sort of shape, as though they were trying to encircle the Israelites. And you don't, if you don't look at the locations for yourself in the Bible, you're not going to get that perspective. And that was something that I'd never picked up on. You know, you look at they were encamped in Shoko, and Azekah. Okay. Pass over it, and you don't stop to thinking about it. And so that really made me think again. I mean, after all the study we did before we went, I thought, boy, I've really got to pay more attention to these locations. And then as we're going to the locations, I'm thinking, when I get back, I've got so much more study to do because there's so many things that I've missed. And you just, I mean, you know that these locations, in a sense, you've always known they're real places. But to actually go there and see them, to be there yourself and sort of be able to picture where the Israelites were, where the Philistines were, it gives you a much better perspective of things. And that was a photo from the side of the road as we approached. We're still in the bus there. And, of course, I had to collect some stones as well. And the guide, he said to us, oh, don't worry, you can take as many as you want. They'll back a truck in here next month and they'll just fill it up again. And then he said, I'm kidding, don't take as many as you want because you don't want to fill your suitcase up with rocks. Which was fair enough. But I did have the same thought as Pastor Simeon and Pastor Dan. I thought, I'm going to go further downstream and see if I can get a rock from somewhere down there that might be one of the original stones. And I was headed down there when I encountered David. And he'd already beat me down there. But that's okay. There was plenty of rocks to go around. Like Pastor Dan said, there's a lot of rocks. Then later in the trip, we went to the Negev and we visited Avdat, where Israel's first Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion, was buried next to his wife. And I took a video of the surrounding landscape. So ignore the tourists. We had a really good panorama from that location.
Look out, it's overlooking the wilderness.
That's the thing when you go with a tour group. Everybody's taking their own photos, selfies, whatever it might be. Some of the guys with more professional equipment. And there's us with our phones. It's okay. So we had a real panorama. It came right the way around like that, and it gave you a little bit of perspective on the sort of terrain that the Israelites crossed through. That's one for all those who kept asking why I wasn't in any of the pictures. I think it was day two, and I had people sending me messages saying, where are you? So I sent back to, I think it was Alana. She said, how come you're not in any of the pictures? So I sent back and said, I missed the plane in Dubai. I'm still waiting to, you know, still waiting to catch up. I was just messing around. So this was on the road, travelling through what was what's known as the Ramon Crater. Took plenty of pictures of the terrain there, and it's very rugged and for the most part quite dry. And the areas that have vegetation are the areas where when the floods come, they run through just certain areas, and of course that's where the vegetation then springs up. The guide did warn us. He said, if you come here when there's floods, it's very dangerous. It doesn't look like it right now because it looks so dry, but when the floods come, look out. And as we went through here, you look at the terrain, and it really helped me to understand why the children of Israel would have been complaining pretty quickly, asking why Moses had brought them into the desert to die. Because you can imagine all these people wandering through this desert area and they've got to feed any cattle or sheep that they've brought with them. They've got to feed themselves. It's dry. There isn't much water. I think you would start complaining too, to be honest. just from my perspective, it's a pretty rough area, and you dehydrate pretty quickly. The guide kept telling us there was, I can't remember the word, but he said there's a particular word in Hebrew that they use, and he said, when you're in the desert, it gets so hot, we use this word, and it means explode. And he said, that's what will happen to you. It gets so hot, you'll explode. I'm not sure exactly what he meant by that, but I take it gets really hot. And there are a few other people who also commented that they also felt somewhat more compassionate towards the Israelites for the sort of terrain they had to travel across. Yeah, no McDonald's. The next location that was impressive, that I felt was quite impressive, was the Dead Sea. And maybe it's because I've heard about it so many times before. I don't know. I really wanted to float in the Dead Sea. And I thought, how can I come to Israel and not float in the Dead Sea, even if the water is cold? I'm going to make sure I do it. But as we approached the Dead Sea, there were a lot of buildings as we're coming from the south, heading up towards the Dead Sea. There are all these buildings and sort of plant and machinery and that which are in place to extract all the minerals from the Dead Sea, and they use a lot of what they extract from the Dead Sea for like your healthcare, beauty care, all that sort of thing. So if you're wondering where that comes from, ladies, apparently it's really healthy to soak in the Dead Sea too. But on the left, there were also some salt hills. One of them was called Mount Sodom, and I was a bit too early with the photo, but it's just on the right of the screen there, up here. That was, the guide told us, was the beginning of what they call Mount Sodom. And the Dead Sea was a particularly impressive place to go. And the water was cold, as Pastor Dan showed, I have proof that I did float there. Don't drink it. Don't drink it. And they warned us about that. They said, don't drink it, and don't even submerge your head under the water. And I got just a little drop splashed on my lip, and I forgot about it and licked my lip. Disgusting. Really bitter. It just immediately makes you want to spit it out. Just as Pastor Dan said, if you drink a cup of it, you'll go into cardiac arrest. And one of the other guys, Steve Boots, he said, never mind a cup of it, I don't know how you drink half a cup of this. It's disgusting. How could you swallow it? And I agree. I have no idea. The bottom of the Dead Sea was like walking on jagged ice. That's the layer of salt on the bottom is so thick. It's like walking on jagged ice. It's crazy. The next highlight was from Jerusalem to Jericho. Well, the hike actually began at St. George's Monastery, and that's in the photo there. And that's a lot more recent building, I think. I can't remember how old he said it was, but certainly a lot more recent. As you can see, it's still standing. But even from here, the hike to Jericho, they estimated would be a little over 5 kilometres. And as you walk along the narrow path, you really get a feel for how treacherous the journey would have been. There's plenty of caves like this. And occasionally you'd see the conies running around up there. But plenty of caves, plenty of crevices for thieves or bandits to hide in and prey upon unsuspecting travellers, like the man who was helped by the Good Samaritan. Because the trail is quite narrow and there is a steep drop at the edge of the path, there really isn't anywhere to escape to if thieves do attack you. More of the caves. That photo, I'm on the path. The path is right here, and I'm standing right back against the edge of the path. And that's as far away from the edge as I could get at that point. So that's how narrow the path was. At some places, the path was literally only about that wide. You only had a width for one person to walk. So there isn't really anywhere for you to go if bandits came out of the cliffs from just above. You've nowhere to run to. And that was quite an adventure for the guide. And I think if he had have known how dangerous that was going to be, I don't think he would have taken 30 people traipsing along that path. And some got a bit carried away throwing rocks over the edge because the water runs along down the bottom of the canyon there. And so you throw a rock, wait, splash, all right. It's satisfying. It really is for a guy. All the girls going, oh. The boys, oh, just one more rock. No. it was really impressive to see the Valley of Megiddo as well. And I've seen it in photos before. You hear about it, but no photo can do it justice. Really how vast it is and how flat it is. It's crazy. You just looking out there, you can easily see how you'd fit millions of people. It runs all the way down there and back across to the left. You'd easily fit millions of people in there. It's a huge space, and you can see why it's just so flat. It's the perfect battlefield. It really is. So going and seeing the Valley of Megiddo was quite special, particularly in light of prophecy as well. Another place that we went to that I found really interesting was En-Gedi. As Pastor Dan mentioned, that's where David hid in a cave when he was running from Saul. And when Saul came up into the cave, David refused to harm him but cut off part of his garment. And in 1 Samuel 24, Saul's men advised him that David was in the wilderness of En-Gedi, and it says that Saul went to seek David upon the rocks of the wild goats. You can easily pass over details like that in Scripture, but it's like most places in Israel, it's quite rocky terrain. And again, it's quite dry out that way. And so En-Gedi would have been an ideal place for David to stay with his men. This is water running through the area, which comes from one of the springs there. I think there was two springs in En-Gedi. And in the distance there, up here, you can see the Dead Sea. But here's some of the caves in that area. Could have easily hidden in one of those caves. In fact, I have it on good authority, that's the one they hid in. Not really. But there's, as Pastor Dan showed, I thought I had it in here, to be honest. I had a good video of where the water runs down from the waterfall there and into the sort of pool at the bottom, and there's plenty of water in there. Would have been an ideal place for David and his men to hide out. So you can see why he would have picked that spot. Plenty of places to hide and plenty of water and a good deal of vegetation there as well. And of course, the big highlight of the trip was Jerusalem. There's no place like Jerusalem. I tell you, it's very diverse, an interesting place. And again, this photo was taken from the Mount of Olives and the graveyard down here is where, if you're wealthy enough, you can be buried there. And the Jews believe that when the Messiah comes, that they'll all be resurrected, and those who are closest to the Mount of Olives will be resurrected first because you're closer. So it's important to get your to make your booking now and get in on the Mount of Olives there. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what the guide said. Very expensive. very expensive. As we stood on the Mount of Olives, we could look straight across to see the Temple Mount there. And you can see the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. But it was really impressive. It was very impressive to be able to stand and, you know, this sort of view is what I've seen on postcards and that sort of thing. You see it all the time, but to actually be there and have that view for yourself is quite impactful, as you consider that we were standing on the very mountain that will one day split in half when the Lord Jesus returns and stands on that mountain, looking across the city, the very place where the Lord Jesus bled and died for the sins of the whole world. Right there. And everything's just continues to go on. Life continues to go on in that place. And the Jews continue to remain ignorant of the fact that their Messiah has already come. He has already died in their place to take away their sins. But as we looked across there to the Temple Mount, I remember I did keep wanting to sing that song, The Holy City. You know, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. It was very inspiring. At the oh, there you go. There's a panorama. And of course, proof I was there. This is at the Israel Museum, and it's a wonderful model of what Jerusalem would have looked like, or what they believed Jerusalem would have looked like in Solomon's day. It's a fantastic reconstruction. It really is. It's a massive work that they've done there. It's hard to describe how big it is. But I mean, you can see the size. I took this from the platform that's above. You can see the size of the people in comparison to the size of like the temple, and you know, there's the city walls around about. It's very big. It's very impressive. This is one of the entrances to the old city, known as the Damascus Gate, and We entered the city. I remember entering the old city through the Jaffa Gate on Saturday, which was our free day, and then we went through the Damascus Gate on the Monday. And the Damascus Gate is the more impressive of the two, but it's also more dangerous. As you come through the Jaffa Gate, you come into the Christian quarter or whatever. But when you go through the Damascus Gate, it's all Arabs there. And I wanted to go through that through the Damascus Gate on the Saturday. And when Brother Lewis came to pick up Pastor Simeon and Pastor Dan from the hotel, he said, "Oh, maybe don't go as a group." He said, if you go on your own, you should be all right. You won't look like a tourist. If you go as a group, you'll just look like tourists." And he said, about 4 hours ago, someone was stabbed to death there. They're still mopping things up. So, okay, well, I won't be going through that gate today. But when we went through there, through the Damascus Gate on the Monday, I remember every maybe 30 to 50 metres, something like that, there was a small group of the Israeli police. Like they were not far apart, and they're all fully armed, ready to go should any problems arise. And you do not feel safe going through there when you've heard people tell you, you know, someone was stabbed here. The guide said, if you go through there, wear a backpack, because then they can't stab you in the back. Can I wear a backpack on the front and the back? You know. And apparently it's quite easy to get robbed there, the guide said. If someone comes up quickly, if they approach you quickly, Just watch out, because they might be pretending like they're going to try and sell you something, but then they'll bump into you and nick your wallet. So I was constantly... Yeah. So I was constantly on guard going through there. Most stressful part of the trip. This is down by the Western Wall, and a lot of us know it as the Wailing Wall, and the guide said, we don't call it the Wailing Wall. No, that speaks of, you know, all the hard times we've been through, but we're in the land again and things are looking up, so we call it the Western Wall. Okay, that's his perspective. They've still got some troubles coming. But you may recognise this fella here with the blue prayer cap on as Pastor Simeon. Something that really stood out to me as I walked through Jerusalem is how much Judaism has become a culture for them rather than, a religious belief. And many of the Jews are actually quite secular, but still practice certain aspects of Judaism because it goes along with the culture. And we noticed when we went through the markets that you come past these Jewish fellas, you know, and they're in the market, they're wearing the yarmulke, and they're sitting there just smoking and drinking in the market, and you think, really? What, you know, you sort of have this veneer of a respect for religion in a sense, but it's not a heart for God. It's just this outward practice. It's just the culture. They have what they call a Shabbat elevator or Sabbath elevator in the hotels. Because of their beliefs about not working on the Sabbath. On the Sabbath, they won't press the button on the elevator because they consider that working on the Sabbath. So they have an elevator that simply stops on every floor on the Sabbath. Due to the command to not seethe a kid in its mother's milk, they won't even serve dairy with a meal that contains meat. So in the mornings, I could get a coffee, but in the evenings, for the evening meal, no, because you're going to have your coffee with milk. And in the evenings, that's when they serve the meats. In the morning, they won't serve the meat. You know, so these little details. One Israeli young lady, the one that Pastor Dan mentioned, we met on the train. She said that there are differences of opinion on how long one must wait after having milk before they're allowed to eat meat. Some say you have to wait 3 hours, and some say 6 hours. That way there'll be no trace of the milk in your mouth when you eat the meat. You can see why Jesus told the religious leaders of his day that they strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. They go to great extremes to keep these absurd little gnats or details of their tradition, but they don't deal with the camel, the big issue of their sin. And it's crazy. You watch them and they are so particular about the way they do things to keep the traditions, but their sin goes undealt with before God. And of course, the last highlight of the trip was Hezekiah's tunnel. And I was right at the back of the group, so there's a lot of splashing going on. See Pastor Simeon about two people in front of me. And the water is about ankle deep in most parts. But at the very beginning, it comes right up to about there. And nobody warned me of that beforehand. And most of us didn't realise that. And as guys, we're all wearing our trousers and we soaked right up to our pockets. And But that's just for the very beginning, and then it goes down to sort of ankle depth. So you spend the whole rest of the time soaked while you're just walking in ankle-deep water. But one of the other guys on the tour did take a longer video, and in the video you see the tunnel twists this way and then that way and then it's back out this way, and it's just twisting and turning with seemingly no rhyme or reason, and yet they still managed to make both tunnels meet up. It's crazy. Even today that would be hard to do with any sort of precision. But they managed it. So that was really impressive. It was not for people who are claustrophobic. Pastor Simeon and I, we both said someone should have warned us, because we both had our backpacks on. And at points, you're down like this, trying to get through, and it's really low, and then you get to another section, and you could fit another one of me on top, and you still wouldn't be touching the ceiling thing. And it's a very interesting experience to go through there. It's all solid rock. It would have been a lot of effort to get to dig or tunnel through there, I should say. But sometimes you sort of like this because it's very narrow, and of course everybody's trying to not drop their phone in the water. But that was quite a good experience. I really enjoyed that, and that's where I'm going to leave it this evening. So that is the end until Seth makes his trip to Israel. Yeah. Yeah, vicariously you've been, but it's very exciting going to Israel. It's great to be there in person, to be able to, I mean the pictures never give you a full view of what's around, and you can never really get a true sense of the place until you're there. And but it's been a real blessing to be able to go. I'm very appreciative to Brother David Cloud for organising the trip, and also to everyone here who's been very supportive, particularly to those who gave to help alleviate the financial burden there. And Israel is not a cheap place to go. And something David Cloud said to us, he said, "You'll go through your shekels quickly." And he was right. You look at the exchange rate and you go, okay, one Australian dollar gets you about 2.4 Israeli shekels. Sounds good. But then when you go to buy a coffee and they tell you it's going to be 15 shekels, you sort of go, hold on, that works out more expensive than what I'd pay at home. So it's not a cheap place. And as Pastor Dan said, when we went to that restaurant that had the fish, it cost us, I worked it out, it was about $40 for a meal.